thousands or millions of people who would never meet each other sharing certain sentiments. And these sentiments has historical background and cultural backgrounds, linguistic backgrounds. And when I started this, of course, conflicts between large groups have certain realistic aspects, as you can imagine, political ones and personal ones and legal ones. But underneath, I figured out that everything is in the name of maintaining and protecting one's large group.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years and have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Vamik Vulkan. Dr. Vulkan is a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst, and he has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize 5 times, which tells you something about the stature of the man and his work over the many, many decades. And that's what we discussed today. He has, I don't know about single-handedly, but he certainly stands as the father of the field of large group psychology, which is an integration of international diplomacy and psychoanalysis. And we discuss what is large group psychology and how it applies to the diplomatic arena. We discuss many of the arenas that he has participated in. He's been involved in international negotiations at the UN, at the government, State Department conferences. He's a player on the world field. He is an emeritus professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia. He's a former president of the International Society of Political Psychology, the Virginia Psychoanalytic Society, and the American College of Psychoanalysts. He was a member of the International Negotiation Network under the directorship of former President Jimmy Carter. And he is the editor or author of over 60 books. He has a new book coming out this summer called Sexual Addiction and Hunger for Maternal Care, Psychoanalytic Concepts and the Art of Supervision by Phoenix Publishing House. And as the books he's written imply, he is not only an actor on the world stage, he's also a clinical psychoanalyst, and he has treated patients for decades, he has supervised for decades, and he has some thoughtful reflections on his many years of practice. He is one of the elders of our field. He's 88 years old and has been working in the field for well over a half century. It's a pleasure to hear his thinking both on the world stage and about our field in particular. Here's my conversation with Dr. Vamik Vulkan. Vamik, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you here. Vamik, I've been familiarizing myself with your quite prolific writings, and it occurs to me that you have two passions in this professional world of yours. The first is psychoanalysis, and the second is international diplomacy. Now, there are many people who have devoted themselves as labors of love to each of those fields, but I think it's fair to say that no one has quite combined them the way you have. And you've combined them through your concept of large group psychology. Now, I say your concept of large group psychology because you really are the father of it. Many people have written, and you've generously and thoughtfully made reference to their work, but to my reading, no one has quite brought the depth of thinking and certainly psychoanalytic perspectives on what are large group psychologies. And there are many large group psychologies. We are all familiar with it. We all have some affiliations with a team, as it were, that we feel connected with. It could be ethnic, religious, cultural. Nowadays, it's often political. And, you know, there's a language of affiliation. We have a common food. We have common dance. Often rhythms of speech and ways of thinking link us with these friendly affiliations. But then there's the other kind of large group, which is the more malignant sort. And if we were to use an individual psychology language, we would use the language of the paranoid position. This is a group that is defined by narcissism and entitlement of us and them, and who has borders, not just physical borders, but psychological borders that are rigid and cold. You talk, and we'll hear more about your concepts of chosen glories and chosen traumas, these events that happened 700 years ago and are treated as if they're today. So time is collapsed, and these are all concepts that you've written about. The one I want to mention that I think deserves notice is, because few other people write about it, is how these concepts impact child rearing. That there are ways that children are brought up where the natural phase of externalizing one's badness, which all kids go through, is reinforced by the family. Your phrase is that they become reservoirs for bad objects, and the families and the culture support the continued externalization into the bad other, with terrible consequences not only for the individual, but for the communities at large. So we're going to talk about large groups, and then we're going to talk about diplomacy, where you have operationalized your thoughts on large groups, and then we're going to talk about psychoanalysis. You have earned the title of being an elder in our field. You're 88, have been practicing for 50, 60 years, and undoubtedly have much to reflect on, and I would be interested in your sense of our field and going forward. But start us off with large groups, but specifically, what brought you to be interested in large groups and how you built your thinking from that point?
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, I need to say a few words about my background to understand why I became involved in studying large groups. I was born to Turkish parents, Cypriot Turkish parents. I was born in a Mediterranean island, Cyprus. And in 1932. And after I graduated from medical school, a medical school in Turkey in 1956, I came to United States because there was a brain drain. They did not have enough physicians in the United States at that time. And they were asking young physicians to come to America. And soon after I came here, because of the ethnic trouble in Cyprus, my roommate at the during the medical school days, who was like a younger brother for me, he went to Cyprus to visit his ailing mother, and he was shot to death. He was shot 7 times by a terrorist for ethnic reasons. And here was, I was in Chicago at that time. I knew nobody. I learned about the death of my kind of brother-like roommate. And I didn't know how to mourn. So when I became a psychiatrist after I went through psychiatric education at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. My first research was on mourning. Many years I studied mourning without knowing why. I went through my analysis. In those days, in analysis, external events were kind of no-no. Here I was going through my analysis. I didn't know if my parents were dead or not, some conflict going on in Cyprus. But in those days, in analysis, focus was internal world, my Oedipus complex, etc. Remember Winnicott, I think it in the late 1930s, he said, if the king dies, the analyst in his office would not know about it. The fact is that, you know, as Freud and many early analysts wrote about, you know, large groups and religion and mythology and so on. But in the clinical setting, the focus only was our internal worlds. And because of this, when an opportunity arose, without knowing, I got involved in studying large groups. Let me tell you about the opportunity. In 1977, then Egyptian President Anwar Sadat went to Israel. It was a big, big event. And he gave a speech at the Knesset. And he said that 70% of the problems between the Israelis and Arabs was due to a psychological wall. And at that time, people who were in power in America, I think they liked Sadat. And I don't know what really happened, but I think they came to American Psychiatric Association and asked the association to study Sadat's psychological wall. At that time, there was a committee at the American Psychiatric Association, Committee on Psychiatry and Foreign Affairs, which means I was a member of it, young member, as well as a Greek-American. I guess they got us as guinea pigs. They wanted to see how a Turkish-American and Greek-American could get together or something. Well, anyhow, this committee, we would meet every 6 months or so and have bourbon and go home. And after Sadat's speech, they sent the committee to Israel and to Egypt. And my Greek friend and I, we were younger. We were not taken there first, but slowly I became the head of this committee. And we were bringing very high-level Egyptians, very high-level Israelis, and later very high-level Palestinians together. And as psychoanalysts and psychiatrists, we had no idea about diplomacy. Well, briefly, I got stuck in it. And after this committee work finished, after 5 years, I opened a center at the University of Virginia. And I knew that I had to have a diplomat. I had a high-level diplomat, a former assistant secretary of state. I knew that I had to have a historian, linguist, and so on. And I opened a center, multidisciplinary center. And soon after that, Soviet Empire was collapsing, and grants were available. And thus, we and my team went to Soviet Union first and brought together Soviets and Americans. Then after that, we worked for, 7-8 years in Baltic republics, helping Russians to separate from Baltic republics without bloody things.
Let me interrupt you because you have a story to tell about Estonia in particular. But before we get to that,
yes.
Flesh out for us what you're learning over these years about large groups taught you.
I learned that, you know, large groups in everyday life, what we say, we are Apaches, we are Sunni Muslims, we are French, whatever. Mm-hmm. They can be ethnic, national, ideological. Thousands or millions of people who would never meet each other sharing certain sentiments. And these sentiments has historical background and cultural backgrounds, linguistic backgrounds. And when I started this, of course, conflicts between large groups have certain realistic aspects, as you can imagine, political ones and personal ones and legal mm-hmm. ones. But underneath, I figured out that everything is in the name of maintaining and protecting one's large group. Let me put this way. Freud wrote about large groups. And I like for you and the listener to imagine a picture of May dance dancers. A big pole and people around this pole dancing, turning around and around, identifying with each other, but they're all connected with the pole, with the leader. And Freud was a discoverer. Everything for him at that time was to explain things kind of by references to Oedipus complex, like Oedipal father and you dance around mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
What I did was to put a canvas on this and make a tent. So what I have studied is the tent of large groups. We are thousands of us, millions of us are under the same tent, including the leader. And we have our own identities. We have own club identities, professional identities, and so on. But we all of us wear the same tent. And tent is our large group identity. And when people come to discuss their problems, we notice that suddenly they would talk about symbols on this canvas. Let me explain to you. For example, we were bringing Estonians and Russians together. And one day, the person who later became Estonian president said something kind of bad about Russians. And Russian delegate, who was the second person in Duma, suddenly started talking about Mongol-Tatar invasion of Moscow and Russia centuries ago. And same thing, if you had Turks and Greeks talking, unofficial, of course, in official dialogues, you mm-hmm. follow certain thing, whatever they gave it to you, but unofficially, we told them we have no, we would help them to talk to each other. We would not give them suggestions what to do because who were we? But suddenly a Greek person would talk about 1453 Ottoman Turks invasion of Constantinople. And this is how we start realizing that large group identity become the main issue which becomes inflamed. And this become very problematic to find peaceful solutions between opposing large groups.
Let me ask you a question about this. Tell me if I understand this right. When there yes. is tension in the here and now,
yes.
One or both of the parties will regress away and talk about the past, however hundreds of years ago it is, to reaffirm and reassure their self-esteem and their difference between the two.
Absolutely.
Which A is something we see in the office all the time, where people will use the genetics, childhood genetics, as a way to sidestep the affective experience in the transference. You've made the point in your writings that for something to meet the criteria to be a chosen trauma to serve this function, it has to be long ago. Made the point, for example, like the Holocaust in World War II is not a chosen trauma because it's too recent. Is that the reason?
Because still people are mourning. I mean, if you go to Israel and you go to Yad Vashem today with Israeli friend, you know, I mean, not only yourself, even if you are not a Jewish person, it's still hot.
So if you're able to mourn an event, it doesn't get frozen into the chosen trauma. I see. Okay.
Yes. So it's still an unended wound. I mean, still is part of your identity, of course, but it's a different kind of thing.
I understand.
If you go to Greece today, do you know of anybody who remembers a family member from 1453?
Right, I understand that. And yet they would feel as if they do.
That's your point. They feel like it happened yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
And it becomes the best example how this is really happens, if you don't believe me. Let me give you the best example of this, that it happens, and how leaders inflame this, and they cause time collapse, feelings about this old things, shared feelings, and present issues become together. Let's go to the collapse of Yugoslavia. And again, when I'm talking about this, I am not saying anything against Serbian people. Let me just say first thing, after getting to know people from all over the world, we are all everywhere. We are the same, okay?
Right.
Everywhere.
It's important to know that these days, right?
Okay. So if I give an example from Serbia, I'm not against Serbian people.
Noted. The record will note that.
Oh, my God. I love them. Yeah. They were so... Milosevic, inflamed the memory of the Battle of Kosovo, which had taken place 600 years ago when Milosevic was alive. 600 years ago, Ottomans and Serbians fought, and Serbian leader and Ottoman leader were killed and so on. And Serbian leader's body later on was taken to northern part of Belgrade. When he became the leader of Yugoslavia, they dug out the body of a 600-year-old body. Can you imagine whatever was left? Mm-hmm. Some bones, and they went from village to village for a year to take these bones back to the battle area, to Kosovo. And so that, in a sense, the 600-year-old memory was inflamed. And there were people that I know who would, they would say to them, that, you know, that it just happened like yesterday. And then new horrible things happened in Srebrenica because they perceived the Albanians as Ottomans. While they were killing them, they called them Turks. See what I mean? This is time collapse. Entitlement ideologies become inflamed when these things happen. So we learn a great deal about how chronic international conflicts become connected with psychological issues. And we wanted to write about this thing so that we could offer some help in diplomacy. Still, you know, there are so many conflict resolution associations all over the world. Most of them, they just do bargaining. They do not have the intensive information.
Let me read just on this point something you've written in your paper on a large group psychology and peacemaking. You say when two large groups are in conflict, the enemy is obviously real, but it is also fantasized.
Yes.
If participants can differentiate their fantasized dangers from the current issues, then negotiations and steps towards peace can become more realistic.
Yes.
Psychopolitical dialogues become a process in which historical grievances are aired, perceptions, fears, and attitudes are articulated,
yes,
and previously hidden psychological obstacles to reconciliation or change rise to the surface. Their aim is not to erase the images of past historical events and differences in large group identity and culture, but rather to detoxify the relationship so that the differences do not lead to renewed violence.
Absolutely.
I thought that was a very clear explanation of how understanding, yes, large groups can be operationalized in the diplomatic sphere.
Yes. And this is, we were able to do, when Baltic republics, small countries separated from former Soviet Union. Can you imagine their fear?
Right.
Russians can come and swallow them in 1 minute. And we helped them by bringing together very high-level, high-level Estonians and high-level Russians for years. And since we were not diplomats, we approached to these dialogues like psychoanalysts. We said to them, here you are, start talking. We are not going to tell you what to do. And first, Estonians, every four months or so, we would bring them together for 4 days. And Estonians would turn blue. We could see their faces turning blue with anger or something, but they could not verbalize it. It took them a couple of years to be able to verbalize their feelings. And once these things came up and what I wrote was taken into consideration, they were able to sign agreements, and because every third person in Estonia was and is still is a Russian or Russian speaker, and there are all kind of problems. And we helped them through these kind of dialogues. But to have, I call them three model, I do not need to get into details of technology.
But this is outlined in your readings that are on the list. And for those, yes, who are interested, it makes, yes, for wonderful reading.
Yes. But for a while, there were also interest in this from, I gave a talk at United Nations in many official meetings of the United States government and so on. But in general, what is happening in the world, technological things, of course, as we know, changing things so much, but diplomatic relationship also changed because a president or a king or a dictator can push a button and talk to the other leader. I mean, ambassadors' roles and so on all change. But how to put the how to explain to these people the importance of psychological issues perceived from a psychoanalytic point of view, still we have some issues in that area.
And do I have this right, that the president of Estonia came from your group that was making
yes,
this
of course,
exchange?
Two of them ran for the president, and one of them became president. Arnold Rutel became the president. Yes.
That's quite a story. Yeah. Your organization, you've built organizations to do this kind of work. What are they working on now?
Well, I retired.
And the organization itself? What are the organizations?
After I retired, my organization collapsed after 1 year, 2003 or 2004. Huh. It was called Center for the Study of Mind and Human Interaction, and it collapsed. But what happened in after that, for I was asked to be a Erik Erikson scholar at Austin Rick Center, which is kind of psychoanalytic informed place.
Yes, yeah.
In Massachusetts, for 10 years I went there, And then I got a call one day, and I'm not going to give his name. The man said, oh, I have $80,000. I want to give it to you. And I said, what am I going to do? Wait, make it short. I asked Austin Rick Center to accept it, and we evolved something in 2008 called International Negotiation Network. And anybody wants to know about it, go to please internationalnegotiationnetwork.com. And you can find out that we are bringing together influential people, psychoanalysts, sociologists, former very important diplomats, Lord John Alderdice from England Parliament, who is very famous there and also went through analysis. He's a psychiatrist. And it's 8 countries: England, Israel, Iran, Palestine, Turkey, Germany, United States. 8? Yes. At that time, they were, when I started this, there was official talks that you don't talk to your enemy. And we brought these people together to look at East and West relationships. And this committee is still working. Now we are teaching psychological aspects of diplomacy and so on. My biggest pleasure in my life during the last, 5, 6 years is that many students from all over the world writing their thesis on chosen traumas or large group identities, and they get in touch with me, and I respond to all of them. And this is the biggest gift anybody can get. It takes a lot of time, but really, I love it. So yeah. It's expanding, not in the psychoanalytic world, not in psychopolitical world, because most of psychopolitical world is kind of focusing on bargaining. But young people, I'm so amazed they're reading these things.
Well, it makes for fascinating reading, I can attest. Let me ask you a question. You began this story by talking about the difficulty you had mourning your roommate. And
yes.
I actually recall when I was a resident in the 70s, yes. I came across your paper on linking objects, and it made such an impression on me, partially because no one else was talking about it. And as I understood, and this is from memory this long ago, your paper back then was about how if you ask people who had losses, deaths, even if they're from long ago, if they have an object,
yes,
that represents the person and the relationship, to bring in the object. And you described so poignantly the outpouring of affects that these objects, and they're not necessarily things you would think, they're not pieces of jewelry or clothing, they could be a can of peas that they keep in the back of the closet or something that just signals for them the lost person. And if they bring that into the session, you can help them get unstuck.
Yes.
And here you're describing your mourning. It's not quite a linking object, but you've described a life's work.
Linking phenomena.
linking phenomena, right. Getting unstuck from is that a fair characterization?
Wonderful characterization. And same thing happens after major traumas. I also have a paper and book about monuments. Monuments are linking objects and linking phenomena for past problems. And when revolutions occur or new fights occur with other people, one of the first thing people do, they go to the monuments and they tear them apart,
yes,
open
yes,
them
yes.
up. Yeah. Linking object is not just usual thing that you remember somebody who or something which was lost, like a picture and so on. Uh-huh. Linking object is a magical object that you externalize your mourning process. Linking object becomes a meeting ground of lost thing and your corresponding self-representation. And this is a very important issue. This chosen traumas and chosen glories are, in a sense, are like linking objects for societies. Yes. And so I wrote many, many books and papers and explained these things. And again, because of this thing, I was not involved in International Psychoanalytic Association or American Psychoanalytic Associations, not politics and so on. I went to all the meetings and met my friends and so on. But the things I wrote, mostly there are references, thousands and thousands of references I hear, but not from analysts, from other.
Right. That's what makes your work unique.
And hopefully psychoanalysts also, now I am writing papers and at the end I'm saying we need to teach large psychoanalytically perceived large group psychology in institutes.
Can you share with us your own large group pleasures?
I developed biculturalism.
Yeah.
I'm an immigrant. And I also wrote a lot of books and papers on refugees and immigrants. I keep my identity, Cypriot Turkish identity. I have a house in Cyprus, of course, because of the COVID. I have not been there over 2 years now. I hope to go next August, hopefully. And when I am in, I go there with my wife and we spend 3 months or so. And my wife says to me, "My God, you're a different person here." Because I enjoy the pleasures of that culture. And when I come to America, then I do my, American identity.
Yeah,
and also I do my family identity. My everybody in my family were teachers, so I love to teach. And as I say, around 88 years old man, every week I'm answering some student from India or Russia or America. Mm-hmm. So it's a pleasure.
What language do you speak when you're spending time in Cyprus?
I speak Turkish and English. Everybody in Cyprus speaks English because it was a British colony once upon a time. But when I'm with my friends or families, I speak Cypriot Turkish, not Turkish Turkish.
Vamik, you've been practicing analysis, and I mean that specifically because while we've been talking about, and you're best known for your large group work, you have, for as long as you've been studying large groups, you've also been practicing psychoanalysis. And usually people choose one or the other, but you've done both.
Yes.
You've seen patients for decades, you've supervised, you've written about both.
I still supervise.
Yeah. What's your sense of where the field has been and where it is going?
But remember Leo Rangel? He was one of my,
Rangel, sure.
Mm-hmm. He was the president of American Psychoanalytic Association twice, and he was president of International Psychoanalytic Association.
Yes, sure.
And he was in California, but he was kind of long-distance mentor for me. He talks, 1970s, 80s, psychoanalytic pluralism. Mm-hmm. This was the time when object relations came up and self-psychology came up. And also the number of psychoanalysts were limited and so on. What was happening was that, just to make a very short summary, Freud is a discoverer of Oedipus complex and internal world, made psychoanalytic treatment focusing on these issues. And even in 1953, Anna Freud said that we should not see narcissistic patients, borderline patients, we should just treat neurotic patients, where we really focus on Oedipal issues in the internal world. But things change. We now know that a person's mind does not develop alone. A baby's mind develops through the interaction with mother and mothering persons. So we know the importance of object relations. We know the importance of the other. And slowly, psychoanalysis, psychoanalysts, even then and now, of course, we see all kinds of patients. And we are focusing, what change is focusing on pre-Oedipal issues when patients come to us.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-Oedipal separations, individuations, even earlier things. During Freud times, main defense mechanism was repression. Today, if we have a neurotic person, that's true. But if we don't have a neurotic person and we have a person with mainly pre-Oedipal issues, main defense mechanism is splitting of images, self-images, object images. So the main good thing happened is paying attention to pre-Oedipal issues and thus allowing us to be able to develop techniques to be able to treat psychoanalytically non-neurotic, lower-level individuals.
I hear
this
that.
This is the biggest help. But meanwhile, as time went on, I'm sorry to say that, we also, something else developed, and I call that super democracy.
Super democracy. Tell me what you mean.
Super democracy hit psychoanalysis, I think. And let me give you a personal experience. Before COVID, you know, I go to meetings in New York, and I probably whole my life I met once or twice going to psychoanalytic, American psychoanalytic meetings. I decided that I wanted to know what younger people do. And so I would look at the program and find out case presentations, go to those meetings and see how younger people treating patients. And some of them were just machine gunning the patient.
Questions.
Tell me this, tell me that. So they're staying on the surface. The guy comes and says, my wife or my girlfriend or my boyfriend doing this and that. And they stay on that topic instead of allowing to see what was repeating, what was also transference aspects of it, machine gunning the patients, these questions. And that made me feel puzzled and, in a sense, sad. And I wanted to, I raised my hand in one of the meetings and wanted to say something about this. And younger people got very angry at me. And they said to me, you're not here. This is a meeting. You're not here to teach us. So I shut up, of course. So there are all kind of ways of, I think now, that what is called psychoanalysis being carried out. And because of that, I gave myself a task without telling anybody. But to report cases, psychoanalytic cases, from first day to the last. I wrote maybe 10 books on this. And in each book I say, everybody with other way of thinking about what is psychoanalytic treatment, they should write from beginning to the end so that we can see, we can understand what changes. And I still suggest that we do that so that this pluralism becomes more visible to study and look and see the good things about it and also probably bad things about it.
And you're suggesting that we avoid the shortcuts, if not deceptive shortcuts, of using theory to represent what's happening.
Yes, we do that in psychoanalytic psychotherapy. But if we are going to be doing psychoanalysis, like we do when we were treating in the old days, like neurotic persons, and transference neurosis evolves, and it goes on for days, sometimes months, transference neurosis, and then it gets resolved, and the patient gains new ego functions with understanding, to deal with, to change behavior patterns, to develop new ego functions. And same thing should happen when we are dealing with borderline patients and narcissistic patients. I don't know what to call them, narcissistic transference.
That's fine. We know what you're referring to, right? But your point is to let the psychoanalytic process, as you're understanding it, unfold, yes, as opposed to just push for conversation and back and forth.
There is, of course, psychoanalytic psychotherapy. But sure, if we are going to call psychoanalysis, we need to know what you do. This is why I wanted to, it's still just, I am having a brand new book coming on the 22nd of this month. It's called Addiction. And okay, it's also a supervised case from beginning to the end to show how things change. And I suspect that we do this, or also we talk about this topic at the meetings in a serious way, so that we protect psychoanalysis. I'm not against psychoanalytic therapy, by the way, but to protect what we call psychoanalytic process, and we define it and hold on it.
Well, I think, you know, we all do what we can do to contribute to our field, to our communities. Yes. And for you to devote yourself as you have, putting aside the diplomacy for the moment, but in psychoanalysis, to feel that if the next generations are going to learn what a real uncovering regressive transference neuroses type of experience can be, yes, that the way to do it is to show how it happens.
Yes.
And to show it, and you've written up your own cases, you've written up the supervisory experiences, and I think that's a lesson for all of us who do this work and who feel that there's something important to transmit. And it's maybe we also worry that it's not being transmitted and something is being lost.
Yes.
Vamik, you have contributed not to just that, certainly, but you have, as you say, people around the world are reading your work, are writing to you, are writing theses on your ideas.
Yes.
It's been a pleasure for me to talk to you. It's been a pleasure for me to immerse myself in your work as I have in anticipation.
Thank you so
much. You really write beautifully. You write very clearly. Let me read something that you closed one of your papers with. And this is actually, you quoted Lord John Alderdice.
Yes.
Who I had not heard of. So I also learned of him. And this is the end of your paper where you say, he says, whatever the dangers of being seduced into acting out the transference in the process of such work, taking psychoanalysis off the couch and around the conference table is not necessarily in and of itself a form of acting out. It is rather a way of facing the reality of personal and communal violence, confronting the ravages of the descent into chaos and death, and transforming aggression into creation of better communal relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's such a wonderful summary of your life's work. And I want to thank you for the work and for sharing it with us today.
Thank you for asking me to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.